Hey, how's it going?
Good, thanks for calling.
Yeah, hey, sorry again about the delay and the rescheduling.
Oh, no worries at all. So, I'm just glad that I have HBO now so I can start Game of Thrones whenever I want.
Oh, nice. That's good.
So, all right, if you're ready, let's get right down to it.
Cool.
All right, so let's start with your year of graduation and your major.
I was 06, Music Biz.
Cool. Do you recall which track you were
in? I want to say there were three within that, right?
There was, like, management and entrepreneurial were the most common ones.
Okay, I guess I was management. I was the one where you're taking, like, the record label and publishing classes.
Okay, probably that. The tracks have changed a little since, although those two are still there.
Okay.
But was that Spring of 06?
Hmm? Oh, yeah, Spring of 06, yeah.
Cool. And what was your primary instrument?
Bass.
Nice. All right, so we'll get to the history later, but tell us about your current job. What do you do?
So I work for a Chinese media company, a U.S. subsidiary that works on games, on mobile games. So right now we're my team, which is just my boss and I, we're helping out with building one of the games, as well as building a chat system and then a chat bot on top of that. So like, we're basically the R&D team. We're kind of doing some of the advanced machine learning, AI-oriented work.
Okay. Do you have the name of the company that you work for?
Yeah, it's called Line Kong. Line as in, like, phone line, and Kong like King Kong.
Got it. Nice. Oh. So is this, like, a long-term employment with this company, or do you kind of move from project to project?
This company is long-term-ish. I guess they convinced me to not to be an employee rather than to consult. I was doing consulting work before. But this is what got me out of consulting and back into being an employee.
Understood. So hey, because I know that being in software, the hours can be, you know, very variable. You know, what's your typical work week?
It can vary. I guess I can talk about this company and then maybe talk about my past experiences. So
sure.
This company is, because it's just my boss and I, and because we've kind of been waiting on other teams to do stuff, which is why we were pulled into the project, is really to help them out a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't had to work that much, so I would say probably like a quarter of my day is just commuting, which is unfortunate since I live in the city and I don't work in the city. I'd say like get up at 8:30, get to work by 10, and then leave the office like between 5:30 and 6:30, so around 6 usually.
Gotcha.
It's probably like not even an 8-hour day if you subtract lunch.
Gotcha, although it sounds like things might heat up later.
Yeah. I think it's one of those things where it's like we're not really doing right now like what we were originally hired to do. So, you know, neither of us is like gung-ho, like pulling in late hours, right, or taking work home at all. But we worked together before at a past company, and I would show up at like 11, and I think he would be there by like 10 or something, and then we'd sometimes work till like 1 a.m.
You
know, that's something that we're really passionate about, or something that's just like, you know, we're like figuring it out and we're trying to get something to work, and it's like neither of us wants to go home until we get it done. But like culturally speaking, I'd say what I mentioned before is probably the norm and probably what most people experience, depending on the company. Because I'd say like here,
mentioned because, before meaning the very long hours.
Oh no, the very short ones.
Like okay.
Like the 10 to, and you know, on like a, on a day where, let's say, like, I just didn't feel like getting in earlier, sometimes I'll get in at, like, 11, right? Which for me is still, it's still, like, I still have to be, you know, like, out of bed and everything by, like, 9 for that because of the commute, but that it would be, like, 11 to, I think my shortest day was, like, 11 to 5 or something, right? At this company, my longest was maybe, like, 10 to, you know, 8, I'd say. I'd say, like, 10 to 6 is about the norm. I think, actually, this is more normal for most of Silicon Valley. Like, most people are, like, 9 to 5, you know, 10 to 6 is kind of, like, the normal hour for most, normal hours for most people.
Okay.
Shorter. But I think it's, like, if there's some project, it'll get, you know, if there's some project and you're really excited about it, you'll naturally just work a little more.
Understood. So, let's see, I guess my next question, well, I know where you're going to be speaking mostly a non-technical audience, although I imagine people who are interested in computers might be listening to this conversation. So, with that in mind, what exactly is it that you said you're working on the online chat? Is this like front end or back end or both?
Oh, yeah. So I can say a little about that. So I'm primarily, I guess my primary role is what people colloquially call a data scientist, which is kind of, I think, like, it's kind of a ridiculous term because all scientists use data and, like, you know, or scientists also, data scientists basically in Silicon Valley just means like someone that can do math and also write code as well, right? So it's really like, we've kind of rebranded it to say like research engineer. That's like the more accurate term, right? Because you're an engineer, but you're kind of more on the research side of it. So, I guess I can say first about the front end back end aspects of the game. So we've been, because the front end team has been hurting the most, because they're remote and they're pretty new to, some of them are just new to programming in general.
By the way, public service announcement, front end is like what the users of the software see. Back end is all the number crunching that makes that happen.
Yeah. So the way to think of front end back end is a front end, the front end is what actually sits on your browser or on your phone, right? We refer to both of those as front end, even though the technical aspects of those are pretty different. And then backend is what actually the code that actually lives on a server. And that could be like a machine, you know, usually run by Amazon or Google or Microsoft that's sitting like in Virginia or, you know, in Oregon or something. So I've worked a lot on both. For this particular project, I've done the front end for the game, and then I've done the chat aspect. I've done both the front end and the back end. So basically, like, we call that full stack. So that's like the entire everything from actually like provisioning the machines. You know, we don't touch what we call bare metal, which is the actual physical machine. We don't deal with that. That's we use Google Compute Engine for that. That's a service from Google.
Okay.
But we will run. We'll like pick the machines and then figure out how to distribute our, you know, our software onto those machines. Everything from that level, right, which is pretty close to the machine, all the way up to what the user sees. So that's like on the engineering side. The chat bot, I guess that's what you were asking earlier, is about the chat bot stuff, right? Mm-hmm. So chat bots are a pretty popular thing, and that's one of the reasons why we pursued it. Is they're pretty hotly funded startup category right now. In general, any startup that's working on the field of machine learning is just the industry term for like what we colloquially would call like artificial intelligence. But it's actually just a bunch of branding because it really just means applying math and statistics to computer science, right? To computation. An example of machine learning is like Google search. You know, you type in a search term and Google's found a way to relate those search terms to actual search results, right? And that's done that's done through machine learning. It's done through basically doing some kind of statistical analysis on, you know, all on all websites they've indexed.
Gotcha.
So a chatbot works by learning learning probable sequences of words. So if, you know, if I typed in like, "Hello, how are you?" Right, the chatbot would learn to say something like, "I am fine" or "I'm great, thanks." And that's traditionally chatbots were done not through machine learning, but through wiring together a bunch of rules. So it would be like, "Do I see this word and that word and that word?" And then I'll respond with these words. And as a result, they were pretty rigid and they weren't really capable of anything, forget believable, but right, but anything even like remotely usable. There have been a lot of advances lately in this technique called neural networks. And I think the marketing term for that is what we call deep learning. I don't know if you've heard of that,
no,
Kevin.
No, what's deep learning?
So deep learning is a fancy way of saying, rather than using traditional statistical models to build these machine learning systems, I'm going to just set up a big, it's called a computation graph, but it's basically like, imagine like a big flexible system, and the system tunes itself over time by looking at many, many examples. But it's almost infinitely flexible and infinitely complex, and so in order for it to produce something meaningful, you need to give it a lot of data. But it can model very complex patterns that traditional statistics, data scientists practicing traditional machine learning have a hard time doing because frankly the human brain is only so powerful itself and can only really we can only really kind of fashion together so many patterns to be recognized on our own. And so this thing basically discovers the patterns without human intervention. Or at least with very little human intervention.
Understood.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool.
Sorry, that was a long-winded answer.
No. Dude, sounds like very interesting stuff. So, hey, do you mind? I know you discussed the hours already, but would you mind discussing, like, what is your typical day, or if you prefer, your typical week entail? Just give it a little more flavor. Like, what are you actually doing when you're at work?
Sure. So, I'd say I'm kind of lucky in that I don't have the typical responsibilities of most software engineers. So I'd say most software engineers actually have a bunch of meetings and they have a lot more structure, right? And for me, it's kind of like we have these long-running projects that we work on. And so basically I'll show up at 10 or whenever I show up. Get a coffee and just kind of start coding. I'll talk to my boss because I sit with my boss and we have our own little pod, our own little room actually.
If there's only two of you, where exactly do you work anyways?
We just work we are in the office, but we have a little room. And so we've actually experimented with working out of co-working spaces.
Mm-hmm.
And that's mostly like just to get away from the noise of the rest of the company. Because believe it or not, co-working spaces are actually way quieter than actual like company offices. I think a lot of that's just you're with strangers, and so there's a lot of like politeness and respect that doesn't really happen in a company where everyone's friends and so people yell a lot. So I'd say like it's the two of us. We basically just took over what was an office and just made it our office, or our area. I'd say we work on kind of interleaving things. So sometimes like we'll work on the same thing and I'll go kind of sit next to him. Sometimes we split work and sometimes he'll do front end, I'll do back end, and vice versa. We're both pretty versatile in that sense. Oh, it says there's internet connection problems.
Yeah, it's okay. Just keep talking. I can hear you fine.
Hello? Hello?
Yeah, I can hear you fine. Keep going.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. So, all right. So, okay. Cool. So, all right.
Yeah, keep going.
We're working. We kind of interleave. We're doing sometimes front and back end. Then it's just, can you, are you hearing me?
Yeah, I can hear you fine. It just creates a time lag.
Okay, can't tell if you can hear me or not. Okay. I see. That's why I was confused. All right. No problem. I'll keep talking. So, we get to lunchtime. Usually, he has a car, so usually he just drives us to some place for lunch. Sometimes we eat lunch with some of the other some people on the other teams. We don't get the typical like Silicon Valley startup benefit of free lunches. I know that's a really big thing everywhere. It's unfortunate, but it's something we're all kind of pushing for because it's kind of a huge time suck to have everyone pile into cars and drive out to some restaurant or something and wait in line, right? So I know a lot of companies will provide that as a perk, but it's really just a way to keep people in the office. Kind of come back and just repeat. Sometimes after lunch, we work with this person, he's called a producer, a game producer. It's kind of like a weird gaming term or entertainment industry term for, I think, what's supposed to be like a project manager. He kind of takes the role of a product manager, but mostly product managers actually have some technical skill, and so they either can code, they can design, or they have some really good domain knowledge. And this person I work with doesn't really have that, so he's more of a project manager. So that part of the job is kind of the less enjoyable part, is dealing with dealing with people that are kind of just like getting on your case about tasks, right? Because we're already pretty good at self-managing. So there's a little bit of that. And so that's really the extent of the meetings that I have. Neither of us really has any meetings, and I have actually like just zero, period. So that's really nice. So there's a little bit of that, but other than that, it's kind of just us sitting in a room coding and then, socializing a little bit sometimes.
You said you do like mathematical stuff. Sometimes, like,
because there's like two of us, and one of us is having a slow day, it'll kind of just be a slow day. So right now, because we've been helping so much with the game, I haven't done as much of that, but, I can talk actually about that. So this is actually outside of work. What I described to you earlier was just like a typical work day that I've had so far, right? But this chatbot thing is this project that's kind of been on the back burner this whole time because we need to finish the game that the chatbot's going into, or we need a game to plug it into, right? So the work on the chatbot I've been doing on my own in terms of just doing kind of preliminary research, and I go to this study group. It's actually held at a university out in the city. I go to the study group. It's about 20 or 30 of us, and every week we bring a deep learning paper. And lately, it's actually been papers that I've applied to chatbots. So that's been very convenient for me. And so what we do is every week we read a paper, which usually takes like several hours of pretty intense work. And I just kind of find some time to do it. Sometimes I'd even do it at work if, day is kind of slow and I just have nothing else to do. But I will, it's kind of what I do between like responding to a Facebook message or, something like that. I'll kind of like read a little part of the paper. It does take some focus, though, so your mind is, you know, for me, sometimes my mind is, like, already in the paper. Because some parts of the engineering work that we have to do now is so unchallenging that, you know, it's like I kind of can do it with half a brain and then go back to whatever, you know, my brain was working on. So I've been reading some of those papers. They're usually from Google or Facebook. Microsoft, I think, had one as well. And those three companies have pretty strong research groups. They actually fund these teams that produce, you know, these papers. These papers obviously are, one, is there a way for these companies to collaborate on, you know, on technology that I think benefits all three of them and really benefits all companies. And the other is it's great advertising because, you know, it's a good way for them to pull in. If you do it in an academic style, right, writing academic papers is a good way to pull in, like, math PhDs, you know, actual, like, computer science PhDs, and so forth. And, of course, to get, you know, people like me interested in what they're working on. So we've been reading these papers. My boss is more of an engineering person, so he's less interested in this AI aspect of it. That's kind of more my domain and why I was brought on. Outside of helping out with engineering stuff, that's been what I've been doing, a little bit at work, you know, and a little bit at night as well.
Very nice.
Yeah. I think that pretty much sums up the day to day.
All right. So one last question before we go on to the next part of the interview is, you know, one thing to qualify for doing these interviews is that you enjoy your job. Now, I will say anyone who reads dense academic papers on artificial intelligence must, by definition, enjoy their job. But I'd like to hear from you specifically, what is it that you like about your career?
I'd say a lot of it is a combination of work style and lifestyle. So work style is something that's kind of free of formalities. I find a lot of jobs, you know, be it corporate America or not corporate America, are they're very driven by gestures, formalities, and, you know, routines that must be followed and processes. And I think we're kind of free of that. And that's one of the nice things about working with my boss and also just working in, you know, this kind of company in this kind of industry. I'd say, like, lifestyle wise, it's nice because other than the commute, which is really the main bummer, in terms of lifestyle, like, the hours are, you know, I really can't complain about the hours. And I'd say, like, you know, you don't really, like, I don't really take the stresses of work home with me, unless I want to, right? And I think that's nice. I guess, I don't know if I'm sure you've looked at my history, so you know I actually went to law school. It's in stark contrast to, you know, lifestyle is stark contrast to what lawyers experience, especially big law firm lawyers. If anything, like, that almost defines their career. It's taking their work home. So, I'd say that's really nice. And I guess the last thing is it's just like, you know, maybe, like, the current things I'm working on right now outside of the chatbot aren't really that intellectually stimulating, but that's largely because I've gone through that phase already where I've worked on, like, every possible platform, every, like, front-end, back-end, infrastructure stuff. I've gotten to do all these things, right? And so I'd say I've kind of mined out a lot of the, like, traditional software engineering kind of challenges, but just the fact that I've gotten to do all that stuff in, you know, 3 years is really amazing, right? Like, I've had bosses who've been supportive, I had people who've, you know, given me all kinds of opportunities to work on different things I've been interested in. So I think, like, in terms of intellectual challenge, it's basically, like, as much as you seek. And right now, right, I'm, you know, this machine learning AI field is actually kind of like I would say it's like a completely separate field in many ways from just regular software engineering. And that's a whole new set of challenges, right? And even in that area, I've already, you know, advanced quite a bit. And yeah, I'd say that's, you know, that's like the final, it's a capstone item that I like about it is for anyone who wants to keep learning stuff, there are always cool things to learn, and then, you know, fun real world applications, right? Or at least applications that, you know, you can appreciate in the real world.
Very nice. All right. So now you said you graduated in the spring of 06. So I'd like us to take it back to the spring of 06, or if you prefer, even a little bit before then. And I'm guessing you weren't thinking, you know, Silicon Valley programmer.
Not quite, no.
So, like I said, put us in the headspace you were at then, and let's learn about your path from there to where you are now.
Sure. I'd say my path was somewhat circuitous. At the time I started Berkeley, I was interested in doing entertainment law. And so when I was picking the major and picking my classes at Berkeley, I actually plotted my entire class list from beginning to end when I showed up. And that's in part because when I took the placement exams, I placed into the top level for harmony and ear training. So I did a little like finagling of classes and realized I could finish in 2 years. And so that was convenient because I'd done this program where you go to college during high school, and I did that for 2 years. So I thought, oh, okay, well, that's great. I can actually do, you know, effectively do college in 4 total years, right, but shifted. I'd say I was pretty focused from the beginning at Berkeley in terms of doing entertainment law. I took all the right classes, for sure. Mm-hmm. It seemed like really interesting work. What changed is, one, I got talked out of going into law school directly because I was actually in the process of taking the LSAT and applying, my last year of Berkeley.
Uh-huh.
And I kind of got talked out of it. Everyone was saying, I think they were right to say this is like, you're too young and, you know, you need a little more real experience. It's always better to get more real experience before you go straight through law school and then come out and try to look for a job with like a grad degree. Right?
Can I just ask, what you say talked out, was this Berkeley professors talking you out of it, or was this like family and friends?
More of like family and friends. Family wasn't even, I hadn't even gotten far enough with my, where it was even worth talking to my family about. Like I was kind of just playing with the idea and I kind of signed up for a class, I didn't sign up for class. I just got like an LSAT book, right? So,
gotcha.
I don't think I even got that serious at the time, but I kind of knew I was on that path. So, I took 2 years off and kind of bounced between working a little bit in entertainment in LA, working for money in Seattle, and then doing stuff abroad. So I did like a volunteer trip to Romania. I lived in Budapest for half a year.
Wow. Taught English
there. I did, you know, the things that you're supposed to do out of like a liberal arts college, or something like that. I think the other one is like teach for America or like Hype Nepal, but you know.
Yeah, you said quote working for money in Seattle. What does that mean?
I went to a temp agency and said like, give me the job that pays the most per hour. And they checked my typing speed, which was really fast. And they said, oh, great, you can do. You know, basically like office temp work. So I was doing something between like data entry and playing with people's spreadsheets and things like that. So nothing too interesting.
Right.
It was a good way to save up money for Europe, basically, is how I saw it. Then I actually like set on my law school apps.
And you were still thinking entertainment law at this point.
I was still correct. So even when I got in, and that's why I was thinking of USC, but instead I went to Chicago because I think that was the right move. Is because you know, they say you go to the best law school you can, right? Not just like the one that has that program or whatever. And as it turns out, there wasn't really that much in entertainment law at USC anyway. So I got, you know, I got the best, basically the best overall deal from Chicago in terms of being the strongest school with a good scholarship package, et cetera. So, even though Chicago didn't have much of an entertainment law thing, as I've learned later, it really doesn't matter because, almost nobody goes into entertainment law immediately. They actually start out working, usually working in some related field like real estate or like IP or something, and then they like intellectual property, and then they kind of transition over, you know, through relationships and just through making partners happy. And so I'd say around the middle of law school is where I really changed my mind about being an entertainment lawyer.
Well, go into that a little bit because you'd been on this path, Berkeley, entertainment law, and then something changes.
Right. So in the middle of law school, my second year, call it 2L, basically your second year of law school. The summer after that, I went to LA. I worked for a film finance firm, and then I worked for media. I'd say that it's like this exercise media company. They were called Exercise TV. They were funded in part by New Balance. This is basically like a startup. It was a media startup. I got to see how the sausage was made. I kind of, most importantly, I got a feel for the culture, right? And all the things that I mentioned I liked about, you know, my current profession, those are really things that I think you have to discover for yourself when you see it, right? And it's easy for all the other jobs I've had, which none of them were really, you know, like jobs that they weren't really like dream jobs or anything. I never really had those things, and I never really knew that I wanted them, right? It's like something you really only discover when you get it, you know?
You mean like the informal atmosphere?
Yeah, these things, right? It's like I never knew that that worked better for me until I actually tried it.
Gotcha.
I'd say that was maybe like the informal atmosphere was kind of there with a startup, and that in itself was kind of a hint. But in general, I think the work just wasn't that challenging. It wasn't interesting at all, and it was very much like, you know, it felt like the job felt like just a lot of rubber stamping, but it was rubber stamping with a fancy degree, right? And so that's, you know, how you justify the big bucks. But it didn't seem like there was anything really analytical or intellectual or creative whatsoever. In fact, I'd say like, you know, being a lawyer is probably the least creative job, except for maybe being like an accountant in, you know, in that field. Like any other job in entertainment is more creative than, you know, the lawyer in accounting. And I'd say in general, like software engineering is actually pretty creative by nature.
Mm-hmm.
And I think like, if I think back to my Berkeley days, you know, one of the reasons why I like music is the structured creativity. And you really lose that in law, and you lose that in a lot of these professional services careers, because, you know, part of professional services is maintaining some appearance of, what's the word I'm looking for? You're maintaining appearances, and you're trying to maintain like that status quo, right?
Right.
So deviation is bad. Whereas, you know, in software engineering, deviation could be bad, right? But also could be brilliant. Could be, you know, money saving, time saving, just plain old cool or interesting. And so I think those are the things I thought were missing, right? And there were a couple other cultural things I didn't like the unnamed boss had some, there was an unnamed boss and or colleague, we'll just leave it vague like that. But there were some like personal things that really bothered me about them, and I think were kind of indicative of the industry, just in terms of like their behavior, the way they treated their family, things like that. And I think that kind of, you know, that along with other things kind of put me off. And I kind of realized, like, if I look to these people and think I'm going to be one of them, right? Like, I didn't really like the idea of being, you know, one of them 5 years down the road. So I kind of reevaluated. I looked at just doing big law firms, and that just seemed even more awful. I looked at management consulting. I looked at investment banking, private equity, you know, all the kind of the prestige, I guess the term we use is prestige whoring. So the prestige oriented careers that you would do out of law school if you weren't a lawyer.
Can I just ask what you say you looked at? Was this informational interviews? Is this just going online and talking to people? What is
a little bit of both, yeah. So with management consulting, I actually got as far as a final round in the San Francisco office for McKinsey. With iBanking, I didn't really get that far because I didn't follow their process, basically. They have a different process, and I was a bit late for that. I even looked at extending my stay at Chicago and doing a JD MBA, a joint degree. Mm-hmm. In the end, I kind of just decided to finish up, graduate, move back home, and then really, like, think about what I actually wanted to do rather than think in terms of, like, what other people, you know, say you should do out of law school, right? So I think I started to realize maybe the rules don't really apply to me that much.
By the way, back home was to...
To Seattle.
Seattle, okay.
Yep. Yeah. I kind of started to realize that, right? Like a lot of the rules and limitations didn't apply to me because I think a lot of people that were in law school didn't really have any other... other than just being, you know, great writers or great communicators or something, they didn't really have any other skills. Whereas I always knew that I was someone who could pick up new skills easily and apply them and do really well if I wanted to, right? Even with Berkeley, I actually had never played. I'd only started playing jazz maybe like a year. I played jazz a minimal amount of time that was required to actually apply to Berkeley. Wow. Just by coincidence, but it worked out well, obviously. And I was actually on jazz guitar, right? So I actually switched to bass my first day. I just went to the bass department and said, yeah, so I kind of want to play bass instead. Can I do it? And then they made me go back and, like, practice a little bit and then audition for it, right? I just kind of look back at my own history and said, well, you know, I'm not these people, right? I'm not these other people in law school where I have nowhere else to go but into these professions that I think a lot of people really hate doing. And they really only do it for the money and the prestige and because their parents want them to. So I kind of just camped out at home for a couple of months. I sent out some applications just to say I did, you know, but at that point I wasn't that jazzed about working for a law firm. Mm-hmm. I got involved with I started going to these, like, networking events for startups quite a bit. Started kind of educating myself in the area. I'm lucky because my dad taught me how to code when I was really young, and I actually took a couple of programming classes here or there growing up. So I actually got back into that around the same time that I started working for this angel investing group.
Can you talk about how you got the job with the angel investing group?
Yeah, I basically went to a bunch of meetups and met enough people where it kind of validated me as a real person.
Business oriented meetups, you mean, or just?
They're startup meetups, so it's a combination of biz people and engineers. Honestly, a lot of biz people, I'd say. And if we were to use entertainment terms, you know, it's like you have the biz, and you have creative, right? Yep. So I'd say engineers are creative, and most of these meetups were like 80-20, like 80% biz, 20% creatives.
Understood.
Yeah. So at the time, I would say I was almost like more of a biz person, but on my own, I was playing catch up. I was studying like crazy. I basically just would sleep like 3 hours a night, you know, at that point, because I would go to these. I would go work for the angel group. Sometimes they had me like talk to companies or talk to some lawyers or something, basically just helping them look at deals, identify risks, and then write up these reports. So it wasn't anything that legal technical, but it was it definitely kind of helped you get in the mindset of an investor, which is really helpful if you're doing your own startup, because then you know what to do to attract investors, right?
Sure.
Or supposedly, at least. So I did that, and I was working on this little project at the time.
I'm sorry, back up. So you went to these meetups, you got to know some people, and somebody just said, hey, I got this company, we could use someone like you, come on board? Or
I was actually going to their pitch meetings. So I basically went to a pitch meeting and then just said, hey, I can see that like you have all these companies and you have these investors, but none of the investors want to do any work, right? They just kind of want someone to tell them, like, basically just to do all the due diligence for them. So I said, hey, I'll do this due diligence for you. Initially it was like, I'll do it for free, right? Because I honestly didn't know if, I was going to do it well, or if that was going to be a long-term thing. So I kind of started out free, and then at some point they offered to, they couldn't figure out what to do with me, so they kind of offered to give me, they were trying to do something where there wasn't like any conflict of interest, right? So it's like, okay, we'll give you like a small salary, and then you'll have some like interest in the investments, right?
Okay.
And I was almost going to say yes, but I was actually working on my own, nighttime, since I was studying software engineering, catching up with that, I was working on my own web app.
Cool. Hmm? And by the way, in terms of studying software engineering, were you doing it through books or through, like, I've heard about a lot of online resources?
Yeah. At the time, the online resources weren't nearly as good. There were a couple of good ones, but it's not like today where, you just type in programming course, right? And they're, the top one, the best ones are already at the top. I think at the time you had to do a little bit of digging. I did a little bit of online, but I actually did it just through doing a project.
And this is by the time we're talking about, like 2010 or so?
So I graduated law school in 2011. So, okay. Yeah, this is between 11 and mid-12.
Gotcha.
Yep. So, so I'd say, like, that basically the year after graduation, right? Like, one year after graduation, other than a few months where I kind of did nothing right after graduation, like, this is what I was doing.
And mostly so, books, you said? Just like...
Not really books. No, I'd say it was web... they weren't really classes. It was like, let's say, like, there's a framework called Ruby on Rails, right? The web framework.
Okay.
It's a system for building web apps. And you just follow their tutorial, do an example, and then I just started working off of that example. So it's like, okay, actually, I want to do this, right? So I would change something, kind of go Google. I'd say, like, I learned by Googling. And that's... Okay. Kind of how engineers do it these days too. There's a site called Stack Overflow that has lots of questions that people ask, and then the best answer is checked, right? And so if you just read that and kind of do a little bit of your own sleuthing, you can start to learn how things are built, learn some general patterns, and also, of course, you get the right answer if you want to figure something out. So I did that. I built basically a prototype for a dating app. This is something that people in law school were constantly complaining about. It's like, oh, these dating apps suck, and like, man, if it'd be great if somebody built this, right? Mm-hmm. So I kind of took that idea as just inspiration for like a fun project. And I actually kind of casually applied to this accelerator. I'd say it was like January or March, something like that, right? And the accelerator actually contacted me. So they really wanted to talk.
An accelerator? Is that sort of like an investor who's...
Yeah, I should explain what that is. So it's like an incubator in a way. Basically, it's a very early investor that is very involved. So it's not like, like a check writing investor. They write a pretty small check, but they give you office space. They have these like lunchtime classes for you. So I'd say it's like a bit of like a summer school in a way. It's like a summer school investor.
Okay.
Yeah. So this was summer of 2012. So this was in Cincinnati with this accelerator called the Brandery. And of all the places I applied to, they were the ones that got back to me first. And because the timing is different on all of these, I was thinking, like, okay, like, how much, you know, how long do I really want to wait, right? Because I really wanted to do this. I really wanted to have some experience building a startup. And, you know, here was somebody that was willing to, you know, take, what was it, like, I think Procter & Gamble's money or something like that, right? Whatever, whoever was funding them. at this point, like, they know that it's all, like, you know, they know it's, like, they have based, like, 100% failure rate, right? So, like, they're willing to try. Because they're not in Silicon Valley, it's really hard to churn out successes out there. So they're willing to try, you know, people from other regions, try to bring them in. So that was, I'd say, a grueling, you know, however hard my self-study time was, that was really grueling. Like, running your own startup is just brutal. So that was, I probably worked 16 hours a day, like, in general. And then the last week before demo day, I worked 20 hours a day. So basically just didn't sleep the last week. And demo day is kind of like the culmination of the accelerator program where you go present. But, you know, to prep for the presentation, you're not only, like, prepping, you're also trying to, like, call up investors, try to get them to go to demo day, which most of them said no because it was in Cincinnati. And the response is usually like, well, Cincinnati sucks, so I'm not going to go there. Sorry. That pretty much was the answer I got, right? It's like, I like you, but I hate Cincinnati with all my heart, so I'm not going to go.
Ouch.
In general, I think not a lot of investors showed up. Like, I'd say we had, even though our presentation was great, you know, we had kind of some, like, fraudsters come up saying, oh, I'll hook you up with, you know, like, it's like, I'm an investor, but they actually weren't, right?
Right.
Like, it was really like they were, like, some, like, you know, some, like, sales shop trying to, like, sell your name to an investor or something. Not only that, but I had to do the engineering work as well. So that's kind of where I got into software engineering, was doing that job, which is basically every single job in the company, and then realizing what I was good at and what I liked.
Declare that a bust and look for another job at that point? Or?
Yeah, so we burned through our money somewhat quickly because we had two remote people who had to come in and out. They hadn't left their jobs yet. Mm-hmm. And so we were flying them in. We had to deal with, unfortunately, Cincinnati has basically no public transit. And so we had to, like, spent a lot of money on just logistics. And then trying to promote with events, that was basically the only way to get users, because we hadn't quite figured out the Google AdWords engine yet. Like, as it turns out, that's the key to success for a lot of startups, is just figuring out how to use AdWords, which is the Google advertising platform, or figuring out Facebook, which obviously that advertising platform didn't exist at that time,
right.
Or it wasn't very developed. So we also didn't. We didn't even worry about mobile at the time because, at least in the market that we were in Cincinnati, a lot of people didn't have, we couldn't rely on them to use apps on their smartphone, right? Like, they were about as advanced as, like, opening the mail app, you know, or using SMS. So they're basically still using their iPhones for SMS only at the time. So we built a web app, and then we tried to promote through non-digital means. Didn't really work, but we spent our money doing it pretty much. And then with a final bit of money, I used it to try to move out here to San Francisco to try a last ditch effort to raise more money, right? Which is, if you look back on it, it's kind of silly, but, you know, it's like, if you have only a few grand left, you just spend it on an effort to get more money. So I actually didn't even plan on getting a job out here initially. I was actually just going to try to keep the startup going. I hadn't really thought about what was going to happen after that. Although I think in the back of my mind, it was like, okay, maybe, you know, there's some chance that I have to, you know, go find a job after this. And it's probably better that I'm in San Francisco than I'm in, like, Cincinnati. Right.
Uh-huh.
That's pretty much the story of how I ended up out here.
And then can I just ask how you got then your first software job once you were in San Francisco?
That was pretty brutal too. That was probably, I don't know if I worked as hard as I did, like, during the initial study phase for getting, you know, for building my own web app, but I definitely had to study for the interviews. I definitely had to do a lot of networking. So I had a couple of friends out here, including the ones that, one of them even, like, offered me, like, an interview for being CEO of one of his sub companies. And I think like they went with, it was either like take someone who's young and hungry and has some knowledge of the entertainment industry, right? Or like take someone who's really, really seasoned. So they went with someone who was seasoned. But that was one of like that was just like an example, right? Of like, oh, okay, if I can get these kinds of meetings, then, you know, maybe it's worth being out here. Maybe it's worth like really scoping it out. So I think I would basically just like drive into the city. I was crashing at my dad's college friend's house down in Saratoga, which is pretty close to like the Apple campus and kind of in Silicon Valley itself, uh-huh. The actual valley. So I'd drive out here. It'd be like an hour and a half drive each way. And basically just like set up coffee meetings to people. So I'd find people on the internet, find like people through friends, find people through applying, just whoever was willing to meet with me. So I probably like have like 2, 3, 4 meetings a day, and then come back home and just start studying. So I would go practice like the programming interviews, which is a little different from practicing actual software engineering. It's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like the way, like, the LSAT, which is a law school admissions exam, like, the LSAT is not really like law school. Same thing, like, software engineering interviews are kind of like, you know, they're tests of things that you would have learned if you did computer science, but they're really specific, and a lot of them don't really apply to anything in the real world. But you got to do it. So I kind of, you know, did the whole dance, it was pretty hard because the standards, if anything, are actually higher if you don't have a degree, a relevant degree. Like, it's actually higher because I think people just have more doubts about you, right? Whereas if you're like a Stanford computer science, you know, the people just give you the benefit of the doubt and kind of give you like an easy question, just to make sure that like you actually wrote code and you didn't just, you know, sleep through all your classes. So I was definitely grilled pretty hard, which basically just meant I had to study extra hard.
How long was this whole job search process before?
It was pretty painful. It was like, I want to say it was like 4 weeks until my first offer, and then two more weeks until I got the offer that I actually wanted, that I actually took. So like 6 weeks in total.
For a lot of other fields, that's not all that long.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. So for a lot of fields, it's not. For software, for someone like, for example, like now, right, I could probably find a new job in less than a week, easy. It's very different. In software, especially here, is very different because people move quickly here. And depending on the company, right, like obviously big companies have just a larger process. But, you know, 6 weeks actually isn't abnormal for a bigger company. But for like a small, you know, sub 100 person startup, it's sometimes like the first meeting, if they really like you, they already know they want you, like you'll already be at an offer stage, right? Where it's like, hey, so here's a nice steak dinner, now like, you know, tell me what it'll take for you to leave your job.
Now, could I just ask, so you said 6 weeks till you got the offer you wanted, about mm-hmm. how many, not coffee meetings, so I imagine you were just sort of picking people's brains about what you needed to know, but how many actual, let's say, interviews do you think you had before the one that hit?
Probably like, of different stages, I'd say probably like 8. So some were later stage, some were earlier stage. By stage, I just mean like it was either like the first meeting or it was, you know, the final round, right?
Gotcha.
So yeah, I'd say 8 different companies about.
Okay. Not bad.
Yeah.
Then just not in full detail, but what then was your first Silicon Valley job?
First job was working for a social media platform, or it's really a commenting platform called Livefire. I guess they were in the news recently since they just sold to Adobe. But it's like when you go to the when you go to some media site, right? They have an article and you scroll down. There are these comments. That's what they build, is the comment system. And as it turns out, the comment system is technically way more challenging than the rest of the site. So like just like putting up pages with text on them and a bunch of pictures is actually pretty easy. The comment stuff and the social stuff and getting people's accounts and everything, that's like the harder part, especially the comments. That turned out to be pretty hard, and that's why there was a company built around it. Yeah, so actually my job there was just doing more support-oriented stuff and less like core software engineering. So I actually started out basically at like the bottom of the totem pole, if you want to think of it that way.
Sure. I've heard that often in tech, if you want to get a major pay boost to have your career accelerate, you move around a bit.
Yep, that's exactly what I did, right? That was the advice I got, and you know, it seems disloyal, but it's kind of the norm. And a good boss will just understand, and they'll usually support you. If anything, they'll actually, like, you know, if they know why you want to leave and you have a good reason, they'll help you out a lot in getting your next job. Mine definitely did.
So I assume you were at the one job at Livefyre, then while you were then putting out feelers for your next one?
It was only after a while. I'd say it was probably when the learning stopped. I was lucky that my boss let me do some of my own projects. So he let me lead my own projects and kind of pitch them directly to the CTO and pretty much do what I wanted.
Chief Technology Officer?
Yes. Sorry, I forget that people don't know all these terms.
My wife works in software, so I know I'm messing.
All right. Yes, for the listener. So I got lucky because my boss actually was a patent attorney, turned startup guy, turned employee. So him and I really connected, and so I kind of, you know, I picked the job in part because of that, and also just because in general I think the company is really good at mentoring people. So I'd say I started out knowing pretty much nothing, at least if I look back, right? I basically think, wow, I knew nothing back then. I actually got a ton of exposure, but the company is a service-oriented company, and so they're kind of stuck. Even like the engineering team and the people doing more R&D are kind of just stuck doing whatever the client wants. And I kind of got a sense of that direction, and it didn't seem like there was as much potential there for me to learn, you know, new things beyond what I was learning. And I got a sense that as the learning was slowing down, I'd say it was slowing down maybe like 4 months in. It definitely had come to like a standstill about 6 months in. So I think that's the time when I was starting to think about leaving, and then I ended up leaving around 10 months in.
Gotcha. And can I just ask, the next job search process, were you at the recruiter's find you stage, or was this still go out and do some applications?
Oh, it was so much easier. Yeah, I didn't even put any effort, right? Actually, like I got a really nice company that a recruiter just contacted me about, and that was actually what started my search, because this whole time I was thinking like, should I leave? Should I not leave? And lo and behold, you know, as the day that I'm in the mood to start searching, a recruiter contacts me. And so I talked to them. So I got an offer with that company and leveraged that. I actually wanted to go there, but the last minute, because I didn't like not having choices. Right? So I thought, okay, well, you know, I should at least like look around. I don't just want to hop. Just a hop. So I think I sent a message to someone on GitHub, and GitHub is this, think of GitHub like the Facebook for code. So it's a bunch of, it's in social.
G-I-D?
G-I-T, Git.
Got it.
Yeah, so GitHub is basically a big repository of all open source code and some closed source stuff that's private, of course, that you can't see. But it's also, it's also kind of like a social hub, in a way, like more like social coding is what they call it.
I think you're the second person I've interviewed to mention GitHub.
Oh, okay, good. Yeah. Yeah, they're an interesting company because they actually practice what they preach. Like, their own team is completely distributed, and so they actually communicate using GitHub, and GitHub is built using GitHub. So,
nice.
In that fashion, right, of like a team that, you know, communicates over digitally, almost entirely digitally.
But you said you use GitHub to find another place?
I actually use GitHub just to find another place, really just for leverage. But as it turns out, the place I found I really, really liked, and so I actually went with them. So, you know, I think those recruiters have blackballed me by now, but I'm not bummed about that.
There are lots of recruiters.
Yeah, exactly. There are lots of recruiters and lots of companies too, honestly. And the company wasn't too jazzed, but I think they understood because, you know, they were really accommodating, I think, but I just didn't think that could last. Like, they said, oh, we'll basically, like, whatever you want to do, right, we'll make it happen. And if you want to learn some new, like, technique or new skill or something, like, we'll create a project for you. And I think I kind of got the sense that they had just given up on building the business, and they were just, you know, basically, like, they were just going to spend the rest of the money, right, and then just kind of disband. And I think that's exactly what happened. They spent the rest of the money and disbanded. Maybe the CEO was really energized about it, but I just got the feeling that the engineers really didn't give a crap, and they were just there for, you know, they were there for the perks and for the lifestyle, and but there wasn't that, like, drive, right? There wasn't. I just knew that if I went there, I would probably be extremely lazy and not actually learn anything.
But you wanted to keep moving. Your career was
exactly young. Yeah. I was already on, like, a rocket ship, so. If anything, like, the rocket ship stalling at the last place is why I was hopping, right, to get on the next one. So, yeah, I got on this rocket ship. I actually really, really liked the people that interviewed me. Through some kind of an annoying internal politics, I ended up at another team. And I actually never talked to a single person on that team. But the VP of engineering, vice president of engineering, and that role is comparable to the CTO role that I mentioned earlier, except that that one is more managerial, whereas the CTO role is more like product, more like engineering visionary, if that makes sense.
Yep.
Usually, and that's also the person that wrote the original code, right? So they're kind of like sitting on, you know, they're sitting on clouds. The VPE, the VP of engineering, is more of like that manager that's, you know, getting everyone to, like, grind things out. So the VPE, we definitely didn't like, and he was actually forced out of the company after some point, but he didn't really get that much support within the company, especially because he was doing, you know, the thing that I just mentioned, right? Like, things like that, where he would have you interview the team, you'd be like, I'm really excited about this team, you know, I want to take the offer, and then you show up and you're like, wait, who are these people? Like,
yeah.
Why am I not working with the team that all gave me a thumbs up and they all liked me, right? After fighting that for a couple of months, I ended up getting to the team that wanted me and the team I wanted to be on. And that was an amazing opportunity. And the boss of that team is actually my current boss right now. I'd say that's very common in Silicon Valley as well, is you find people you like working with and people just kind of follow each other around to different companies. So there's really almost zero loyalty to companies. So there's definitely a lot of loyalty between people.
Oh, interesting. That is interesting.
Yeah.
All right, well, and then let's move on to the third part of the interview. So,
okay.
First question for you. What, if anything, is your current relationship with music?
Ooh, let's see. I guess I can almost, it's sad, I can almost list them out now, right? Like, so not a whole lot, sadly.
Yeah.
It's how I do my commutes, is listening to music. But I do listen, you know, I do actually listen to, like, the things that I picked up at Berkeley, right? So a lot of the old school R&B people. I'd say that part has definitely changed my life forever. Like, I think before, if it weren't for going to music school, I'd probably be, like, a top 40 person, right? So that's probably the biggest one. I'd say karaoke, sadly. That's horrible to even say that. But the last one is, like, I have been trying to, like, arrange a little, like, small practice space in my room. I'm one of the few people that actually has, like, a real living room completely to myself. So I'm pretty lucky there, and I've been trying to find a way to take advantage of it. So I'd say aspirationally number three is, you know, play with I have another Berkeley friend out here, actually. So, you know, play some music with some friends, maybe, like, try to tag along or be like a sub for bass for some band. Aspirationally, that's number three. But sadly, my relationship with music is pretty minimal at this point.
You've been a very busy guy. I can't blame you.
Yeah. It's that. Right.
Well, my next question for you is, again, thinking about what you do now. And, you know, now back to your Berkeley education. And, of course, you know, Berkeley gives that one degree, a bachelor's in music degree, and perhaps in hindsight life would have been easier if you'd done a little more computer science. But, you know, let's say at least relative to perhaps a liberal arts college, is there anything you feel that your Berkeley education did well to prepare you for your current career?
I would say on the ensembles. Yeah, I'd say, like, ensembles, anything with ensembles and group projects. I probably naturally, like, pretty antisocial, and I like working by myself. So I think Berkeley was really good about getting me to, you know, getting me to work with different kinds of people, people of different skill levels, different styles, etc. I think that's probably the biggest impediment for most people in engineering is, you know, there are plenty of people that are smart, but not all smart people are easy to work with. So I think being someone who's easy to work with is, that's something you do learn at Berkeley. And that's something you definitely don't learn in law school. Like, if anything, law school is very isolationist. So, yeah, I'd say big kudos to Berkeley, the ensembles. It was also just, like, in terms of my memories of Berkeley, that was the, you know, those are some of my best memories, is playing in the ensembles. So, yeah, that's... I'd say that one was probably the biggest.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right. So now let's flip that question around. Is there anything where you look back at your Berkeley experience, you say, and what you do now, and you say, you know, it would have been really useful to learn this at Berkeley, and they could have taught it to me, and they didn't. Obviously, gives that bachelor of music degree, so you're not going to get a minor in computer programming. But is there anything where you say, you know, I should have been able to learn that at Berkeley?
Yeah. Well, I'll say this: the music business program. I don't know what it's like now. By the time, I think it had kind of a bad rep because it didn't. I think none of the classes were as rigorous as they could have been. And it's not that, like, you know, you needed, like, it's not about the specific, like, subject matter learning, right? Really just that I think the non-music classes at Berkeley could have had the same level of rigor that some of the music classes had. I think the rigor is what, I think in many ways it kind of builds good habits and builds good character. And that's something that, you know, if you look at some of my alums, like the ones that are successful now are the ones that, you know, have like that amazing work ethic. And I think a lot of people didn't get that work ethic trained into them. I had a different experience as I kind of compressed my time there. So I had a crap load of classes, right? I was always working my butt off. I think there are people that kind of coasted there, and some of that has to do with the fact that I think there are just some really easy classes there that I think could have been rigor is the word I'd use. In terms of specific learning, though, not from my profession, but I know that a lot of people come out with they come out kind of like starry-eyed, and they don't really understand, they don't really know what to do in terms of, like, actually building a music career. And so they kind of just, like, in this mode where they're waiting to get signed or something. Right? I think it would be nice if in, you know, the music biz degree, well, maybe the music biz degree shouldn't be a degree and they should take the classes and distribute them to, you know, take some important classes and kind of distribute them to the other majors, right? But I think one of them should, that doesn't exist, is like a guide, you know, the guide to like how to build a solo musician career, right? Because that's what most, you know, if you're going to be a musician, that's kind of what you're going to be doing. That I'd say that criticism, you know, is pretty universal, right? Like I'd say that about law school as well, as law school doesn't really prepare you to run your own, you know, legal shop as well. So I think that's the kind of like reality check that Berkeley doesn't give you. I think that's probably something that's missing.
That's a great answer. I will say that Berkeley went through a major curriculum redesign in like 2008, 2009.
Okay.
I know the music business program has become more robust, at least in terms of how many credits people have to take.
Okay.
But, you know, I couldn't say, I started teaching at Berkeley in late 2005. So I can't say too much about, you know, your experience, you know, versus how, you know, what exactly has changed. Plus, I'm in the class.
Okay.
but I will say, you know, some stuff has changed. I feel like there is a career-based capstone class, although it might just be one credit.
Okay. Yeah. I will say the school probably overemphasized some of the legal aspects. From my perspective, right, like knowing what I know, I would say like it's really not that important. And you know, you're not gonna make a career out of like, you know, out of like suing like a Grammy star, right, or something. So like, I think the, you know, for example, right, like, because this industry is like changed so much, I think like right now, if I were to say there's like a reality check class, it'd be something like, how do you get views on YouTube, right? I mean, it's something as simple as that, because that's a really common way for people to get discovered there. Or, you know, something about around playing gigs and like things like that, I'd say. It shouldn't just be a capstone class. That's like, you know, that is like what people do, right, in terms of their musical career. And unfortunately, a lot of people have to supplement that with another career as well. So then they, you know, it even becomes more important how they spend that time, their spare time, to like be able to get gigs and things like that.
Sure. That's great. Okay. So next question for you is, I mean, it sounds like, sure, you went to law school, you had a couple detours along the way, but you found an amazing career, an amazing path. Like, you just hear the way you talk about it, how much you enjoy what it is you do. There are other Berkeley grads who have not yet found that path. Or perhaps, you know, people in their last year at Berkeley are staring out into the big scary world and wondering what, you know, what's going to happen. For either or both of those groups of people, do you have any advice?
Yes, I'd say, especially like coming out of undergrad, I'd say like, consider how little you know, right? As I think a lot of people, I noticed this about myself, about other people, especially looking back, a lot of people tend to be overly certain about, you know, whatever it is they believe in, whatever it is they think they know, right, about the world or about themselves. I'd say go experiment and go try different things, because I would have never gotten here directly, right? I know me, and I'm too hard-headed to like have gotten here directly. So I'd say like experiment, explore, and be willing to do things that, you know, you might not expect to like. You know, I think my path was like based on necessity, right? Just like, I'm running out of cash kind of thing. And I think that's I think that's okay. I'd say, like, for people not to be afraid of that. Because for someone who's normally pretty responsible, like, I've put myself in those situations, and it's actually gotten, you know, it's actually been great learning experiences. I'd say you learn very little from just doing, like, the same old grind, right? So, yeah, say, don't, you know, if you don't like what you're doing, don't just do the grind. Like, find ways, you know, find different paths. Be willing to take risks.
Very nice. All right. I have one last question for you.
Cool.
Which is, well, you know, as they say, you have the mic, and you are being recorded. So, for posterity, is there anything we missed? Is there anything else you'd like to say?
I think we covered a lot of stuff. Yeah, I think that the last thing I, you know, last thing you talked about, I think, was, would have been what I would say. I guess, like, maybe to emphasize that point more. I get this, you know, kind of criticism or feedback a lot, right? And I think I have a good response to that. There's this concept in economics, the sunk cost fallacy.
Sunk cost fallacy, that if you've already put lots of effort into something, even if it doesn't seem like something worth doing now, coming in fresh, it's so hard to walk away.
Exactly, yeah, right. And it's because the idea is, like, the cost is sunk, right? So if you were to think about it rationally, you would say, like, okay, what is my marginal cost, right? And what's my marginal gain from that? And so people don't think that way. They'd say, oh, well, you did all this stuff. You went to music school, let's say, or it's like you went to law school, then you're not pursuing that. Like, it's such a waste, right? And it's really tempting to think that way, because some of it's also just irrational sentimentality, right? So you have to be able to get out of that, I'd say. And that's really what helped me, is that I was able to just detach and say, okay, like, you know, that's part of being really desperate, right? Is at some point, if you're really desperate, and you're trying to figure out, like, what am I doing with my life? You're willing just to detach and say, screw it. Like, I'm going to start fresh. What do I do now? Like, I'm in a situation now. Forget about all this history of all these costs that I've sunk, right? So that's my advice, yeah, for someone, like, graduating from Berkeley. You know, if it makes sense to do something music right now, do it. If it doesn't, that's totally fine, right? If you find something else you're really interested in, but definitely don't feel obligated to fulfill some kind of, you know, destiny from, you know, from choices you made before.
Okay, that was great. It's a great note to end on.
Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here. Sorry. So that was a great thing to end on. I know, what a time for it to come.
Sorry. I'm having trouble hearing. I think the delay is back. There it is.
Yeah. Anyway, I just wanted to say that I really enjoyed this conversation, and it was really great to hear about all your path, as well as the absolutely fascinating stuff you're doing these days. So I wish you best of luck, and look for...
Cool. Let's see here. I think the delay back up. Here you go. Yeah, thanks for chatting as well. I'll stop, let you talk.
No, that's cool. Just wanted to say thank you very much for this conversation, and have a great evening.
All right. You too. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Bye now.
Take it easy.